I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Build a better life, serve a greater cause, cash an extra paycheck. Three Indiana women had different reasons for joining the National Guard. The one thing they shared, none of them expected to be sent to war. Deployed to Afghanistan in 2004 and Iraq in 2008, the women faced discrimination and hostility from male soldiers who viewed them as potential liabilities in combat zones. The women struggled to keep up with their responsibilities at home while thousands of miles away in a dusty, lonely war zone. Pieced together from documents and interviews, journalist Helen Thorpe chronicles the everyday trials of three women in the U.S. military. She joins us on Midday after the news. And good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Listening along here at WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO over on the Eastern Shore, Ocean City, Maryland, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. Michelle Fisher, Debbie Helton, and Desma Brooks, three Indiana women with very different reasons for joining the National Guard. Build a better life, serve a greater cause, cash an extra paycheck. The one thing they had in common, none expected to be sent to war. Michelle Fisher was 21 years old at deployment. She joined for a better life and the opportunity to go to Indiana University. She saw the National Guard as a chance to pay for her education, climb out of debt, lose some weight, and get in shape. Later, in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, Michelle was embarrassed that these were the reasons she enlisted. Debbie Helton joined when she was 34. She saw it as an opportunity to serve a greater cause, one that her father, a drill sergeant, also supported. She was 52 by the time she arrived in Afghanistan, excited for the chance to serve her country. The single mother of three young children, Desma Brooks, liked to say she joined on a dare. Desma had a rocky past, dropping out of school and giving birth to her son as a teenager. The structure of military life, the chance to earn better pay appealed to her. She deployed at age 28. I mentioned these women. These three women are the main subjects of Soldier Girls, a new book by veteran journalist Helen Thorpe. Helen Thorpe has written for The New Yorker, Slate, and Harper's. She's contributed radio pieces to This American Life. Her first book was Just Like Us, The True Story of Mexican Girls Coming of Age in America. And now this book, Soldier Girls, her second book, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. Helen Thorpe, it's great to have you on the Midday Show. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. It's great to be with you.
What brought you to this project?
I was interviewing different veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and I was doing that because I just felt I'd been cut off from understanding their personal experiences because the wars they were fighting in were far away and hard to follow. And there's this huge division between the military and civilians in our society where, you know, now that we have an all-volunteer military, civilian society often, I think, is a little bit emotionally disengaged from those serving in the conflicts because they can feel that they're not liable to be drafted and they may not go themselves. And so I feel there's this big gulf between those who serve and have personal experience of what deployments are like and then the rest of us who are staying here at home. And I was trying to understand what people were going through who were going on these multiple lengthy deployments. And then I came across Michelle Fisher. As you mentioned, the three women in the book all served in the Indiana National Guard, and I actually live in Colorado. And Michelle had moved to Colorado after leaving the Indiana National Guard. And so I met her through a friend of a friend, and she was so smart and articulate and funny. And even when she was describing really hard circumstances, she would do so with humor. And she was really able to convey so much about her experience. And then she introduced me to Desma and Debbie. And I was struck by how they represented very different points of view around whether the wars were a good idea or a bad idea, very different points of view on what service in the military was like, and really different life stages from a young woman with no children, a single mother with three children, and a woman who became a grandmother while they were deployed.
More women have served in Iraq and Afghanistan than in any other conflicts in our country's history. Today, it's about 15%, I think, women in the armed services. So you were particularly interested in how women, why women enlisted and how they functioned in the military.
I was. And, you know, I think we've seen a big surge in the number of women serving for a variety of reasons. You know, there was the women's movement and the transition to an all-volunteer military at the same time. And the confluence of those two things led the military to start recruiting more and more women to join. And then it was, in particular, the use of tuition benefits, college benefits, that were a primary enticement to get lots of young women to sign up. And you see that kind of represented in these three women's biographies. So Debbie Helton had joined very early on in the 1980s. She's the oldest of the three women, and she had really joined for traditional reasons of patriotism and wanting to serve her country. But over her time, and she was a pioneer, she helped integrate women into this particular National Guard unit. But over time, she saw many younger women like Michelle Fisher joining, who really just wanted college tuition. And they didn't necessarily want to go on deployments or actually even serve in the military on a full-time basis. They just wanted to figure out how to pay for college.
And actually, with Michelle, I mentioned that in the introduction, she was a little embarrassed that was one of the reasons she had for joining up, a little embarrassed, particularly after the Twin Towers collapsed.
Yeah, she was. She had finished basic training, and she was in training to become a weapons mechanic when 9/11 actually happened. And on that day, she had. They were studying the 9mm that particular day, and she had a training weapon that she had taken apart, disassembled, and she had the pieces of the 9mm spread across her desk when a drill instructor burst into her classroom and said, "There's a terrorist attack happening." And there's a plane in the air, and we don't know where it's going. And this military base, she was at Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland. And he said, this military base is one of the potential targets of that airplane. And if something happens and you hear loud noises, jump out of the windows. Hmm. And she just sat there thinking, why would I jump out of the windows? And she was trying to puzzle through his instructions and trying to make sense of it all. But as soon as the shock of what was happening, you know, wore off a little bit and the news began to sink in, she got it right away that everything was different. She had signed up for these reasons that seemed sort of fanciful in retrospect. College tuition, maybe she could lose weight at the same time. And now she understood everything's going to be different and she could possibly go to war.
Michelle Fisher, by the way, is a pseudonym, right? The only woman of the three that required that?
Correct. I offered all of them that. They requested that that choice to use a pseudonym or to use real names at the very outset. And I said, yes, we can offer pseudonyms if that's what you want. And they said, okay, we'll decide at the end after we spend time with you and get to know you better. And then she did choose a pseudonym.
You spent quite a bit of time with them. Would you say I've read in one of the reviews 4 or 5 years of research on this, Helen?
Yeah, I started the project in 2010. I met Michelle at the very beginning of 2011. And then we did 3.5 years of interviews. During that time, they also turned over. Debbie had kept 6 diaries, and Michelle managed to find letters that she had written to her father or boyfriend, and they had kept those letters. Desma turned over all of her medical records and therapy notes, a lot of material like that.
In the time before our first break here, Helen, we have a couple of breaks that we take during the hour with you. Let's talk a little bit more about each woman, and then we'll go on with their stories after the next break.
Sure.
Michelle, we heard a little bit about her. Interesting young woman, music-loving, pot-smoking, left-leaning hippie, would you say?
Yeah, that describes her
okay.
pretty well. She was wearing a rainbow hemp anklet while she was mobilizing for her deployment to Afghanistan, yeah.
Okay, and she's the one who signed up to get, hoping to get to Indiana University through military
yes.
benefits. Parents were divorced, very close to her mother. And so the military provided maybe, you know, an opportunity, you said, to lose some weight, get in shape. We move on to Debbie Helton, who's interesting because she's one of the she is the oldest of the three and a pioneer. She joined the military back in the 80s. And one thing I wanted to ask you about here, she was a single mom at the time, right, when she went to sign up?
Yes.
And that was that a problem for her at the time in 1987?
Yes. So the military does not recruit single mothers or single parents to sign up. And she was told that by the recruiter when she first tried to join the Army, which was a little bit earlier than when she actually joined the Army National Guard. So she was turned away the first time she tried to enlist because she was a single parent. The second time she tried to enlist, she was still a single parent, but she had learned that because she was trying to enlist for the Army National Guard, which represented a commitment of 1 weekend a month and 2 weeks in the summer, they were a little bit more friendly to the idea of single parents joining a guard unit, but she would have to give up legal custody of her daughter while she went to basic training.
Okay, now we get to Desma Brooks then, who is a single mom. Debbie, by the time you're writing about her or interviewing her, she's a grandmother. But Desma, now Desma has three kids, right, at the time she signs up?
Okay, so Desma had one child at the point when somebody dared her to enlist in the Army National Guard.
Ah.
She was dating a man at the time, and they actually married after she signed her enlistment papers, but before she went to basic training. So at the point when she started basic training, she was married with a child that she'd had previously in
okay.
a different relationship.
Okay.
And then she went on to have two children, and then she and her husband divorced. So she was a single mother with three children at the point when she deployed because her marriage had ended.
Okay, thank you very much for clarifying
yeah.
that.
And right.
so all three women, well, I guess like most people in the National Guard everywhere, even the reserves, didn't expect all this to happen, didn't know that 9/11 was going to happen, didn't expect to be deployed to first Afghanistan and then Iraq.
Right.
The two that went to, all three went to Afghanistan, Michelle, Debbie, and Desma, and Debbie and Desma also went to Iraq.
Yes, all three served together in Afghanistan, came home. There were several years before the Iraq deployment. Michelle did not choose to reenlist, and she was actually out of the military at the point when the orders came for her original unit, with Debbie and Desma still in it, to go to Iraq.
Right. Well, yeah. This is very interesting. We've set up now who the motivations for each woman, where they're coming from in life. But it's not like after 9/11 they ran down to enlist. They had already been enrolled in the National Guard. And I wonder if, you know, there's a difference in terms of what? Patriotism, zeal, sense of duty, sense of service for those who went in, actually signed up after 9/11 versus those who were in these units, such as the Guard and the Reserves.
You know, I think that Debbie Helton probably would have run down to enlist after 9/11. Out of these three women, she's the one who is... she kind of represents the good soldier in a sense. She's very compatible with her colleagues in the Guard. She's very, very pro-military. She believed in both wars. She wanted serve her country. So I think she would have been the kind of person who would have enlisted anyway. Michelle Fisher is sort of represents the opposite type of person in the sense that she opposed both of the wars, and she would never have enlisted post 9/11 because she never intended to serve overseas in a wartime situation. And what's interesting is there's 30 years difference in age between Michelle and Debbie, and when they do deploy, Michelle kind of adopts Debbie as a second mother to help her through the deployment. And in many ways, the book is the story of those personal relationships, what happens when they find themselves overseas.
We'll take a break here, Helen, and come back and talk some more. Veteran journalist Helen Thorpe, our guest in this hour of midday. We're talking about her new book, Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War, She chronicles the lives of three women, Michelle Fisher, Debbie Helton, and Desma Brooks, who were members of the Indiana National Guard, deployed all three of them to Afghanistan and two of them to Iraq. This is Midday on WYPR. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us for our conversation with Helen Thorpe, whose book, Soldier Girls, has received some very nice reviews, including comments from Doris Kearns Goodwin, the historian, an absolutely terrific and important book, she says. Helen, let's talk a little bit about what the women did in the Guard and when they were deployed to Afghanistan, what their duties were. Let's start with, we'll go Michelle, Debbie, and Desma.
Okay. So Michelle Fisher, as I mentioned, trained as a small weapons mechanic. Debbie Helton had also trained as a weapons mechanic, but originally she had trained to work on the big guns like howitzers or the guns on tanks. Because Debbie is the oldest of the three women and was in the military for the longest amount of time, over time, her job specialty actually vanished. She did initially what it was called fire control, making sure those big guns would shoot straight. But that all became automated. So at the time that they actually went to Afghanistan, Debbie had also become a small weapons mechanic. So Debbie and Michelle worked together as weapons mechanics on the armament team. And you might imagine they would be fixing American weapons. And for a little while, they did. But American soldiers weren't breaking their weapons. Their weapons weren't breaking often enough to keep the armament team busy. And so an enterprising first sergeant decided maybe they should work on Soviet weaponry that was being given to Afghan National Army soldiers, their allies. And that's what they did. They wound up working on AK-47s, which was unusual for an American weapons mechanic. And Debbie thought that was romantic and fascinating. And Michelle found it horrifying because she was worried about where those weapons might end up.
And Desma.
Desma Brooks, yes, meanwhile. So in Afghanistan, Michelle and Debbie were leaving the post to go work on these AK-47s. Desma was always staying on the post. She was part of, you know, they were all part of a support battalion, and Desma was part of the maintenance team doing maintenance on vehicles, and her job was actually to track that maintenance being done by the mechanics. So every time a truck would come in and be fixed, Desma would be tracking exactly which truck it was, exactly what services had been done, entering all that into computer software to track the maintenance work being done by their support battalion.
A little bit more on Desma and her deployment, getting orders, her training and all. It sounds like she got yanked around quite a bit in terms of what was expected of her. And she had to juggle these three children. She had to find someone to care for them.
She did. And you're right. She did get kind of jerked around a little bit. Desma actually, before they really deployed to Afghanistan, Desma went through what she calls a false deployment. 1 year earlier, she was told she was going to Iraq in 2003 at the beginning of that conflict. And then that deployment never transpired, but she did have to find placement for her children in 2003, go and live on a military base and go active duty and start training as if she was going for several months before she found out that she wasn't really going to Iraq. So then she went, collected her children, and 1 year later got orders to go to Afghanistan. One more time, she found other homes for her children. She just had 2 weeks to find homes for her children, and then she needed to be on the military base in active duty mode. And then she went through the Afghanistan deployment, was apart from her children for a full year, returned, was home for several years, and then got orders to go to Iraq. So it's almost as if her children lived through three deployments, although one, they, you know, it was interrupted before she really went overseas, though they were apart from her for a few months then as well.
You know, on the subject of redeployment, what are your thoughts on that whole thing in the way that was handled by the Pentagon during these years? We didn't have enough troops. We had to keep redeploying folks from the National Guard and the reserves.
Yeah.
And the regular Marines and Army.
You know, it's the biggest question of all, I think, in many ways, because it is so unique in our history to rely on such a small number of people over and over and over again. If you think back to Vietnam, when we did have a draft, people were drafted and went one time to Vietnam, and then they were done unless they volunteered to go again. And in this conflict, it's been very different in the sense that we now have what we call an all-volunteer military, and we just relied on the same people within that all-volunteer force to go over and over and over again. We've never really done that before, and people, I think, are at the end of 10 years of this sort of conflict that has involved many lengthy multiple deployments. You know, people are in much worse shape, and we're seeing evidence of that all over the place, including, you know, this Iraq veteran who, you know, just broke into the White House, I think.
Right. And the subjects of your book, Soldier Girls, we'll talk about their struggles after deployment when they came home a little bit later in this hour. Helen Thorpe is our guest, Soldier Girls, her book, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War, three women from the Indiana National Guard, who all three of whom were deployed to Afghanistan, and two of whom went later to Iraq. Now, a lot of folks are probably curious about their relationships with the men who dominate the units that they were with. So let's talk about each of them, Michelle in this regard, Debbie, and Desma.
Sure. So Michelle was 21 when she deployed to Afghanistan, young, attractive. The ratio within their support battalion was about 2-1, men to women, but they were alongside of all-male infantry units and then NATO units that were often all-male as well. So the gender ratio was extremely skewed. And in that environment, a lot of the male soldiers seemed to view Michelle as a scarce commodity. And that's how she felt. She was propositioned from the moment she left her tent in the morning all throughout the day until she went back to her tent in the evening by guys who wanted to get to know her better. And she found it oppressive. At the same time, you have Debbie Helton, who's 30 years older than Michelle, who is not getting that degree of attention and is even a little bit wistful or nostalgic for it and is thinking and writing in her diary, it's a long time since, you know, men were paying me that sort of attention. There's a very real threat happening at the same time. I don't want to only, you know, make light of this. You see across military posts in both war theaters during this period, huge rates of sexual assault and even rape happening. During the second deployment to Iraq, Desma Brooks is even told that she shouldn't go to the communal bathroom or the showers without a knife. You know, she should be armed at all times. So they are operating in this environment that is somewhat hostile and involves some very real risks. Michelle Fisher decided at a certain point that it was better to have a boyfriend in that environment to sort of ward off all these other men. And she found that when she did align herself with a boyfriend and sit at mealtime with him, that the other men would sort of leave her alone. So that was her coping mechanism. She would later struggle with that choice because the man she chose to have a relationship with was married. So it's an extramarital affair for him. And she took the relationship very seriously. She thought it was going to continue after they came home. But it didn't. When they did get home, you know, he fell back into a pattern of selling drugs and unhealthy habits. He frightened her. He became threatening to her when he felt her pulling away, and she ended up breaking the relationship off. And she sort of is living with a sense of guilt for having been involved with a man who was married, and almost a sense of fear that she would have chosen to get involved with somebody who ultimately turned out to be threatening and a little bit scary. Desma had an affair with a married man as well. He was actually a superior in her chain of command. So it was completely against the rules for him to be having a relationship with a subordinate. And Both of the men were violating the rules against extramarital affairs. So for many reasons, their relationships were problematic. Some of the other soldiers in their National Guard unit felt critical of their behavior. But Michelle and Desma explained that every time they went on a deployment, they tried to start a new relationship, and then they tried to hold on to that relationship after they came home, but inevitably it wouldn't survive the transition back home. And what they ended up with was essentially a decade of broken relationships. And that was a huge part of their emotional experience, and they did want to be candid in talking about it. Debbie made different choices. She had a partner at home who himself had been in the military. He was extremely supportive of her the entire time she was in Afghanistan and when she was in Iraq. She had been married twice before, and when this man had asked to marry her, she had said no, she didn't want to do that again. But he was such a source of support to her through her year in Afghanistan that when she came home, she actually proposed to him. And she says the deployment strengthened their partnership and led to their marriage. So very different set of choices, very different outcome for her.
Did Desma and Michelle share with you how it was possible to have enough privacy to have sex in the military when deployed into a combat zone?
They had stories about the efforts that people would go to try to find that sort of privacy. And Desma came up with a system that was sort of a joke, but it kind of then turned into not so much of a joke, where she wanted them to stick a white sock outside of their tent if somebody was using the tent for that purposes. And then the other people who lived in that tent would know not to enter the tent right then. So there were things like that going on. And, not everyone in their National Guard unit was trying to have a relationship while they were overseas, but enough of that was going on that everybody was kind of aware of the fact that some people were having relationships.
Helen Thorpe is our guest. You're listening to Midday on WYPR. Her book is Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. Desma, she confided to you that she had been sexually assaulted much earlier during the recruitment phase. Is that correct?
Yeah. Desma has a complicated history and a very challenging set of life circumstances. So if you go back to when she was a child, she was actually placed in the foster care system during her middle school years. And she doesn't like to discuss the circumstances around that. But some sort of abuse occurred to her during her childhood that led to her being taken out of her own home. Later, as you're mentioning, she was assaulted by a military recruiter. None of these three women were actually assaulted during their time in Afghanistan or their time in Iraq, although they lived in an atmosphere in which you can understand how in that environment assaults would be happening at a high rate. Years later, therapists would try to get her to talk about some of her original experiences with abuse or assault, and it's something that she's very resistant to, and she doesn't like to think of as defining her, or having anything to do. She says it has nothing to do with who I am. It has nothing to do with how I lead my life. And, I think we can think about whether that's true or not. Maybe it has quite a lot to do with how she leads her life.
In terms of what they did, Michelle, Debbie, and Desma, what they actually did or got to do in Afghanistan, Michelle expresses long periods of boredom, operating in a supportive role, right, for the infantry, and not actually getting into battle to fight al-Qaeda. Could talk about that? Was Michelle the only one who expressed that regret, or would Debbie and Desma also wish to be closer to the action?
So during the period of time when they're serving, they're operating in this environment where women, by definition, are restricted from doing certain types of jobs. So women, for example, if you sign up for the Indiana National Guard, which much of that guard is infantry, women cannot be infantry soldiers during this period of time. And so instead, they're in a support role. So they're doing all sorts of things. They could be, as Desma is, tracking maintenance on vehicles that are primarily being driven by infantry soldiers. Or as Michelle and Debbie are doing, you can fix broken weapons that are probably being carried by infantry soldiers. They're meant to be in jobs that are a little bit safer, relatively speaking, than the infantry itself, which are those jobs are restricted to men only. So they're living in this environment where gender is defining how close or how far away from actual combat you're supposed to be. You see some of that start to shift over time. And when we get to the Iraq deployment, Desma is actually doing work that's far more dangerous.
Well, we'll take a break here and talk about that when we resume our conversation then, Helen. Helen Thorpe is our guest on Midday Soldier Girls. Her book, published by Scribner, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War, a chronicle of three women who joined the Indiana National Guard and ended up deployed to Afghanistan and two of them to Iraq. More on this when we get back. This is Midday. Welcome back. Dan Rodericks here with Helen Thorpe, author of Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War, the war in Afghanistan first and then in Iraq. The three women, Michelle Fisher, Debbie Helton, and Desma Brooks. And Desma, I wanted to focus on a little bit here because we were talking about her before the break. And she's the one with the three children, and she's half a world away, first Afghanistan and then Iraq. And could you talk, Helen, a little bit about her struggles to have those children cared for while she was away?
Yeah. So when Desma deployed to Afghanistan, she had a matter of weeks to get her children settled in other homes because the orders came, and then within a few weeks she had to be at Camp Atterbury in active duty mode training to deploy. Her son went to live with his father. It's actually not his biological father, but a man that Desma had been in a relationship with for a long time, who's the closest thing to a father that this boy has. Her daughters went to live with her first cousin. Desma's very close to her first cousin, Leslie, and Leslie has small children of her own. So she got the children settled. She went to Camp Atterbury. She would still see the children during the time she spent at Camp Atterbury mobilizing. But then once she went to Afghanistan, obviously she didn't get to see them in person anymore. So for the rest of that, for the year that she spent in Afghanistan, it was a matter of trying to stay in touch with them primarily by phone. During that deployment, the children were really not yet using email. They were very young, and they would sometimes, you know, scrawl a little note to her on a card or something like that. During her second deployment to Iraq, they were often staying in touch by email as well as by phone. When Desma went to Iraq, again, her son chose to stay with this man that he considers his father. But he was angry at this point in time about another deployment happening. And he said to his mother, "I'm going to go live with my dad, but if I start high school there, I want to finish high school there. So I'm not coming back to live with you again." And Desma understood why he wanted to go to high school for 4 years in one school. And ultimately, she supported his decision to do that. But it broke her heart because he was her firstborn. And she knew just how disruptive these deployments were for him. She initially, during the Iraq deployment, was hoping that her cousin would take her two daughters again. But her cousin really basically said, "Well, if you need me to." And Desma understood from the way her cousin said it, it was just too much. She couldn't ask that a second time. And so her daughters were originally supposed to live with their paternal grandparents. And actually, their grandmother died. She had a rapidly progressing case of cancer. And she died while Desma was still in the United States, but already in active duty mode. And that was an incredible tragedy and disruption. Their plans were sort of thrown into disarray. Their paternal grandfather said to Desma, please, can they stay with me? That's what their grandmother would have wanted. Desma wasn't sure if that was a good idea, but she didn't want to move them yet again to another new school. So she did let them stay there. And then ultimately they wound up with their father. And Desma and her ex-husband, who's the father of the two girls, they have some conflict in their relationship, and they don't actually agree. Their perspectives differ a lot. And he would say that he's a very loving parent. Desma would say he's a very lenient parent and didn't provide discipline. And they argue about whether he's a good father or not. And he maintains he really provided those children with a lot of love and care while she was gone. But Desma feels that was not the best home for them. Hmm. And so when she got back from Iraq, due to the fact that she was gone multiple times and because the children had great difficulty for a variety of reasons with these different places that they went to live, she returned home from Iraq to children who were angry with her and upset. And because she had a very difficult deployment in Iraq, she also returned home not in very good condition.
Well, Desma also in Iraq, she was actually in a vehicle, driving a vehicle, when the vehicle hit an IED. No one died, but she suffered a concussion. She had some injury to her arms and hand.
Yeah, so Desma, during the Iraq deployment, as I mentioned earlier, you know, she was trained to work on computer software, tracking maintenance on vehicles. Mm-hmm. That was the job she was meant to be doing, that she had trained to do. But during the Iraq deployment, her support battalion was broken apart and the individuals in it were put into other units wherever their brigade needed personnel. Desma was initially transferred into a previously all-male infantry regiment that was going to be doing convoy security. The men in that unit were actually so hostile to her that she requested a transfer, and then she wound up in another previously all-male unit, this time a company inside of a field artillery regiment. And they were also doing convoy security. So she's on the highways of Iraq driving a gun truck at the front of a convoy, trying to make sure that ammo or fuel or water can get to the military bases that it's intended to supply. Sometimes she was in the navigation truck, the third vehicle. Sometimes she was running assistant scout looking for roadside bombs. And one day when she was running assistant scout, they did hit a bomb. It was a big bomb, and they were very, very close to the bomb when it went off. Everybody inside her truck got very severe concussions, and Desma was later diagnosed with what's considered a milder case of traumatic brain injury. Of course, you don't want traumatic brain injury of any severity.
Right.
And she did injure her shoulder as well. The traumatic brain injury, she was grappling with a migraine-sized headache constantly from that point forward. It requires medication to lessen the pain. The medication she takes creates a lot of memory issues. So she came home with anger issues, memory issues, a whopping headache that she had to take pills every day to subdue, and a bad case of post-traumatic stress disorder.
And how is she doing these days?
You know, one of the amazing things about Desma Brooks is that she is a survivor and she's a fighter and she's a great advocate for herself. So you see her in the book really advocate for herself very well at the VA. She does get the right diagnosis in the end of traumatic brain injury. They don't immediately diagnose that condition, and she does keep pushing and seeing doctors until they diagnose it correctly. She does get good treatment at that point in time. And also because she was willing to be so open, she shared all of her therapy notes with me. And you see her get really excellent therapy for her PTSD. She sees two different therapists, and they try two different approaches. The first therapist is operating on a hypothesis, which is widely accepted, that if you experience trauma in your childhood or your youth, and then you are traumatized in a war environment, you are more likely to have PTSD because the original childhood trauma compounds what happens to you in the war zone. So she's trying to get Desma to talk about what happened that led to her foster care placement when she was in middle school. And Desma just resists. This is not comfortable for her. She doesn't want to do it. It makes her more angry. So that pursuit is not successful. The second therapist instead says, let's just work on modifying your behavior. And she gives Desma homework assignments like, can you sit in a crowded restaurant with your back to the door and let people you can't see but you can hear come behind you and walk around you? And Desma can't do it. I mean, it just freaks her out to do things like this. But over time, as they work together, the therapist gradually gets Desma to reduce her hypervigilance. The therapy is very uncomfortable for Desma, but it's also successful. It works.
I want to talk about Debbie and coming home. And Debbie, the oldest woman of the three that you wrote about, she's suffering some PTSD. She's crying, having crying jags here and there. Interesting quote here. When she goes to the VA to see a doctor about her moods, surely there were other soldiers who needed the session more than she did. Why should I take something if I wasn't really injured? She would say later, I didn't lose a leg. I didn't get blown up. She told you that she felt like she was wrapped in saran wrap, like there was a physical barrier isolating her from the world.
Mm-hmm.
And she decided to see a therapist. This is very interesting. So tell us a little bit about Debbie post-war.
You know, I think Debbie Helton, in many ways, she admires her father so much, and she joins the military because her father was in the military. And she always wanted to serve in the military. Part of what she's struggling with when she comes home is that she found the deployments so fulfilling that her life at home seems meaningless to her by comparison. And it's very hard for her to re-engage with her civilian life. She also likes being told explicitly, here are your orders, here's how you're going to spend your time, this is what you'll do today, and knowing she just should put on the uniform. And at home, in her civilian life, she's kind of bewildered by all the clothes in her closet and having to make all these choices about what to wear and having to be self-motivated and figure out how to spend her time that day. So she's very much struggling. And in that almost World War II-like, she admires her father so much. She thinks she should be like him or like a soldier who served in World War II. She should just be tough and suck it up and figure all this out on her own. She's really uncomfortable seeking help. And it's very hard for her to decide to see a therapist. Funny enough, when she does finally seek help and shares that with her close friend Desma Brooks, Desma says, well, I'm seeing the same therapist. And they start to compare notes on this therapist, and they both have noticed that she really seems to like shoes and has a lot of different shoes, and they are, you know, gossiping about their therapist in this way. And that makes Debbie much more comfortable, knowing that she isn't the only one who actually needs professional help settling back into life at home. And it's their friendships that I think, you know, save these women in the end, that they don't feel quite as isolated as they would otherwise without one another. They're able to share the experience of the difficulty transitioning back home.
And Michelle is interesting, too. Michelle, her duty, her commitment to the National Guard ended in 2007, so she didn't go to Iraq, as did Desma and Debbie. Tell us about her a little bit. How has she fared in the years since then?
You know, Michelle thought she was going to be ecstatic when she got out of the National Guard because she felt so ill-suited there. I mean, she didn't fit in well. And she, you know, she was essentially almost an anti-war activist inside of a soldier's uniform. And it was, she feels that she had almost a moral injury, is the term that she uses to describe the state of inner conflict she was in, being asked to serve in wars that she didn't believe in. So when she folded up her uniform, she thought she was going to experience nothing but joy, putting it away in a closet. And 2 weeks after her commitment to the military ended, Desma and Debbie got orders to go to Iraq. And as soon as that happened, Michelle suddenly felt as if she needed to go to Iraq. And why was the military sending Debbie, a grandmother, and Desma, a single mom with three kids overseas, when she, Michelle, didn't have any children or grandchildren? Shouldn't she be going in their stead? So her enjoyment of getting out was very short-lived. As soon as her unit got new orders, she felt tremendous guilt for having gotten out.
Hmm. Almost like survivor's guilt. Huh?
Exactly. Yeah. I think it was exactly that. But then she compensated for that by writing faithfully these long emails and sending care packages to everybody overseas, and was able to find those emails and share them. So you get to see, you know, her in her own words as she's writing to these friends she's so close to and worrying for them.
Did she get to go to Indiana University?
Yes. Michelle did get to live her dream, not exactly in the fashion she had envisioned, because the deployment to Afghanistan interrupted unexpectedly, the dream that she was thinking. But she did get to go to Indiana University. Once she arrived on the college campus, she had a little trouble fitting in because Bloomington, Indiana is a classic university town, very liberal. The climate there was anti-war. You would think Michelle would fit in well because those were her sentiments. But as soon as she revealed that she had been to Afghanistan, people assumed that she was, you know, very pro-military and assumed all sorts of things about her. So she just started having these very difficult conversations anytime she revealed that she was a veteran. And she started hiding the fact that she was a veteran. She hid that part of her identity while on campus just to make her life a little bit easier. It wasn't until she moved to Denver, Colorado, and successfully connected with progressive veterans who shared her political beliefs, that she began to kind of integrate these two sides of her personality, somebody who would oppose the wars and yet served in them. Finding the veterans community, it happened to be in Colorado is where she connected with them, really led to her feeling more coherent and a greater sense of integration around all of her experiences.
Well, Helen Thorpe, there's so much more here, but we're just about out of time. I appreciate what you've done with this book, not just because you're writing about those who volunteered to serve and served in those two wars, but also specifically about women and their experiences here. You know, what really happened to these three women who signed up to serve in the National Guard and ended up all three in Afghanistan and then two in Iraq. I wouldn't say it's an untold story. It's obviously a story Americans are aware of. But, you know, we really don't pay as much attention, and we didn't during all that time that we should have. And I'm grateful for you. It's something we've discussed in the show quite a bit, and it continues to be a subject of conversation about who serves and how we deploy people in this country for military service. So thank you very much, Helen.
It's my pleasure. This was a great conversation.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, I'm really curious about reading more about these women. You can do so from Helen Thorpe's book, Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. Helen Thorpe, a veteran journalist, spoke to us today from Denver. Thank you again for being on Midday.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to our first hour. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll stick around for the second hour. We'll take a break here. We got the news coming up from NPR, and we get lunch for our guests and our staff here, provided today by Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East in Baltimore. The Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven, thin crust pizza, gourmet sandwiches, pastas, salads, and more. Bagby Pizza is open daily from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., and they have delivery available nightly from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. Thanks to Bagby for lunch. Please stay tuned for the news, and then we'll see you for the second hour of our show,